One does, he has to go with a list. I have a list of subscribers of various left-type publications in my pocket, and I had a list of various other political activities in the past, but I also sought out the old Deb Socialists.
Oh.
And you know, you come upon an elderly man, really elderly, who'd been a fighter for Debs way back when, you know. Maybe he was a railroad worker. Yeah. Maybe he was a member of the Socialist Party. But just as you say, these people, all you have to do is to sort of find them. And one thing that young
they're
people...
They're just like hidden seeds in granaries, you know.
One thing that's important, and I want... See, I have to sort of remind myself and other people of this. When I was young, I was active in this political movement. And... very active. I was the president of the Washington Commonwealth Federation, and let me see, 1936, I was born in 1910, so that makes it, I was 26 years old, and I was head of this rather big organization throughout the state, and there were people working in the office, old people. I would call them old, I don't know how old, probably not as old as I am now.
Yeah.
They were old people. You know, I never knew who they were, I knew their names, and I thought, and I, my mother told me not to be arrogant or superior, and I really wasn't, it wasn't a practice. I would sit and talk to them, but I never found out who some of those people were. Why do you know that among the people that sat there in anonymity, licking stamps and doing what they could do without any claim upon anybody for recognition, were leaders of the IWW, who had fought in the camps with arms to organize the camps in 1914. Now, I didn't know who they were. I didn't even know till I read a book about them. On Seattle, Revolution Seattle, and suddenly here it's studded with the names of people who sat in this office and licked stamps. You know, it's just too bad that
that's
we were such fools about history.
Yeah.
And I say this about myself. I was a fool about the local history. And
because we're fools now that we don't use social wealth like your own. You know, that it's, I think we should be more aggressive and go out and, you know, say, well, I'm full of history.
Well, maybe so. One feels a little bit modest about that. I know I'd be willing to talk any place I was asked to talk, but I hate to go around and get somebody by the
butt
and
say,
listen, talk to me. I know something. I mean, this is pretty hard to do, isn't it?
No, there's ways of, like, these young people. There were just two old women, myself and Mrs. Hawkins, who sparked, you know, their, and we told them they were idiots. They didn't know anything. They just didn't begin out of nothing. They had a root. And they're playing this play in the villages and the streets in Minneapolis, you know, about the struggle of the people of Minneapolis. And they got big masks of Hill and Jim Hill and all the big thieves. They got pictures of them, you know, filled with berries and...
Well, I tell you, your state led in a number of ways. And one way I remember was that when the American Guild had a strike on the big papers down there in Minneapolis and St. Paul, that there started to be a little rough stuff organized by the employers of the papers against the pickets. And right away your governor, I think it was Benson at that time, right away your governor said they're not going to have any violence in our streets. And he sent the National Guard into those cities, and he said there'd be no picketing, and he put padlocks on the doors of the newspapers. So there was no newspapers either. He wasn't going to have any violence in his town. Well, now, this is a new application for today, even, of the theory of law, mm-hmm. You know. It was very new then.
Mm-hmm.
But
that was when the timber workers were on strike, too. He sent them food.
Yeah.
The state took up food, didn't they?
Yeah, well, that, you see, now that raises a question. Do we want the state to be impartial? Oh, man, there, you know, you're really talking about something fundamental about politics.
Mm-hmm.
Should it be impartial? Should he have sat there and let the employers and the workers fight it out in the streets? Should he have done that? No, he chose to take a side. Which side did he take? He took the side on which the majority of the welfare of those people depended. Namely, you get a little more money, you spend a little more. This is called, in old Keynesian terms, increasing the purchasing power of the masses. I mean, you can defend it in a thousand ways, but he was standing with what he felt were the majority of the people, and he used the state power for that purpose. Now that's what I want out of politics. I don't want an impartial government. I want a government that's on the side of the mass of the people and is actively accepting their suggestions and actively listening to them and actively doing something about what ought to be done. That's the government I want.
No, that's
I think these little examples from the past might help reinforce.
Olson was so impartial. Remember during the strike, he arrested his own headquarters.
He did?
He arrested the Citizens Alliance, and then he... I guess if you're in power, that's it. That's a important
Yeah. I think that the question of the independence, when a candidate says, I'm an independent, he may be honestly mean that he is. But really one has to ask, of whom are you independent? Mm-hmm. You know, if he's independent of people, we certainly don't want him. Mm-hmm. If he means to say he's independent of bank control then he, or some other control like this, well, then maybe we can listen to him. But this is a strange word. These words always, there are questions that have to be asked about each. I'm independent. Well, of what? I'm for the people. Well, what people? What kind of people? You know, this kind of thing. Then the government now, just pretty plain, it's just a great big executive committee for the corporations of this land. And they give us what they think will keep a section of us quiet here, there, and the other place. And they make concessions to maintain their very real power. So they're not impartial. They certainly aren't. And what we mean to do is to get them out. The process is twofold, please. First, they have to be forced to give as much as they can. And in that process, and I mean forced by the mass of people, and in that process, the mass of people ought to be able to come to the conclusion, and I believe they will be, well, giving as much as they can isn't enough, so let's get rid of them. I mean, I think this is the way it has to go. And you don't go out to get rid of your government, you don't go out to get rid of the people in office, you go out for a program, and you get what you can any way you can get it, from either any party that'll give it. But if they don't give what you really want, then maybe you've massed enough power, popular power in the whole nation, to achieve a government which is more representative. I feel this is the way we have to work, or ought to work.
I think the third parties have had this struggle about people now, of heroes or leaders also. Mm. Like, you could look at Townley and the Nonpartisan League. Well, everybody knew that Townley was not even a good socialist, but he was a silver-tongued orator, and even the socialists disbanded in North Dakota and thought they should support him and get him in power, and then they would do something. But that's it doesn't work, because they told him when he got in power, he eliminated them, and they had no organization. They actually dissolved the Socialist Party, which they shouldn't have done any more than the Farmer Labor Rights should have dissolved their association. If they had kept that, then they would have had some tool against Humphrey, you know. But they dissolved everything in the anxiety to get somebody elected, and that is Olson is the same way. When Olson got in, he didn't do anything. Benson was the only one that had any kind of guts to oppose the steel and the big corporations that destroyed him in the end. But I think that's an important thing, that you don't build up machismo leaders, because they always betray you.
Well, that's right. Now, what does a political destruction mean? I mean, Benson was destroyed in the end. It means very little if there is an organization which is properly prepared to move in with other leadership. And that's what's basic, is basically not, if there's one leader upon whom everyone depends, and that leader is either disgraced by some scandal, or he turns a little crooked, or he's just, or such publicity is poured forth against him that even his own supporters are half divided about him. I mean, so he's destroyed. Mm-hmm. But that's not too bad if there's some other way of moving. And that's basic organization you're absolutely right about, is it. It's got to be there. The willingness to return again and again to the wellspring of political fortune, and that's the minds of the people.
Well, all these organizations did a great job, like you say about the Commonwealth, the Nonpartisan League, and the Farmer Labor Party, and the old Populist Party. Mm-hmm. They really had an educational program that was immense, and the IWW probably had the greatest educational program that's ever been in America. I mean, they distributed millions of pamphlets and their newspapers, and everybody was a conduit to carry this message. But even then they could behead them and destroy them.
Yes, they were, I think they well illustrate what I was talking about when I began with my talks. They were powerful economic organizers, trade union organizers, and their theory, of course, was that we didn't want any specialization of labor in the trade union movement. We want everybody in one big union, and so that all the workers would work together. And then we get this thing built up, and we pull off one strike, and we change the whole constitution of things, and we move in, and we have a workers' government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, there's a simple grandeur about this concept,
yeah.
And the people who proceeded with it were heroes. They absolutely were heroes. They were jailed again and again. If you remember the great free speech fight in Spokane,
mm-hmm.
where YW got up and spoke, and he no sooner opened his mouth than whack, he went off to jail. Well, they simply got on the railroad trains and they just came loading into Spokane, and they kept speaking up there until the Spokane jails wouldn't hold them anymore. And after that, there was free speech in Spokane, at least for a while.
Yeah.
And these people were great. But the fatal flaw in this organization was the flaw I was accenting at first, namely that they relied on this one means, whereas I think one must have the one means that they talked about of each strong economic action, and one must also learn how to control the state so that it doesn't destroy the other means of demonstration and petition and press that we're supposed to be able to use.
And we still have that possibility in America. We haven't got fascism yet.
That's right. That's right.
We still have it.
But this is very important. People just get on their own horse. Some of the very people who fought on the streets, the demonstrations that were so effective in this country, now go around and say, oh, those demonstrations, they're old hat, they don't do anything. Well, they did something. Among other things, they caused the President of the United States not to run for re-election. That's one of the things they did.
And they educated
them. They educated a lot of people.
To go on one of those marches, you were never the
yes.
same. They don't do.
That's right. Of course, they're not going to change the course of history all by themselves. Now, anybody who thought that they would was just mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
But they are powerful movements. You know, that whole trade union history of England is fascinating from this point of view. It had these vacillations. There's the Chartist movement, which was a political association, and it had 14 or 15 principles, and one of them was to get the members of Parliament paid for their services so that workers could go there instead of the gentlemen. Well, the gentleman from the land or from the banks, you know, who had money could support himself, he didn't have to be paid. So there were lots of democratic type things in this. Well, that was broken up. They won a few small reforms, and then they turned wholeheartedly to economic organization, and they built up a strong labor movement, or tried to. And that was smashed by the troops. I forget the hill now, but that was smashed by the troops. And then there was a setback, and they turned again to some sort of political action. And finally, they got themselves a formula which is ultimately workable, and that is a labor organization and a labor party. And a labor party has socialist notions, and whatever criticism one may have of the actual character of this whole thing, fundamentally it's a form composed of two groups. There are neighborhood associations, clubs of this labor party, and there are basic industrial units of it. And just let this group get a program which unites them with, say, the young people and the middle class and the women and so forth of England. Let them get this kind of group and let them fight for it hard, and they control the future. I mean, it's a form for controlling. It's one of the people's many arms for controlling the future.
Does that still exist in that kind of organization?
Yes, yes. It's very strong, and it may well win the next election over there. But the big trouble is that, well, a trouble is that when the Labour Party has gotten in, as it did after World War II, after it came in, the general scope of British capital, British imperialism, is so closely allied with American imperialism that they would have to have a more radical socialist break from their past tradition than they've so far been willing to accomplish. Otherwise, they can't face American capital. They just can't do it. With the American people, with American money coming in and buying up their industries, you know, so much of their automobile industry and other industry there is controlled by American capital. So they cannot conduct the kind of what I'd call thorough socialist program there unless they're also willing to take a policy of curbing the aggressions, I think, the financial aggressions of American capital. I mean, the foreign policy and the domestic policy have to be thoroughly related, I think, in that land. And I believe they have to be here. I don't see how you can be a socialist here and be for the support of the government in Vietnam. I mean, that's incomprehensible. You really have to have a unity between your foreign policy and your local policy, I think.
Don't you feel that in America that there's a democratic heritage in our people? That, I mean, I think that in all crises, the radicals even think we are not Germany. And, you know, in 50, I think the radicals made a mistake in thinking, well, we're going to have fascism. They never counted on this root of democracy in our people. And I feel this is what the young people are really going to draw up. You know, like an artesian well. They're trying to. They have difficulties. You know that in the Minnesota Historical Society, there's hardly any materials for them to look at. I mean, Benson destroyed his papers. Mm-hmm. I mean, the radical movement never put things in there for them to look at because they always felt that was an enemy institution, that was the state, and they'd probably destroy or use it or give it to the FBI or something. But they don't have any materials in there. They're just beginning now to go. They're going out and taping people that are still alive, and trade unionists that led strikes, and this history isn't even available in many cases. Talk about Negro history or Indian history. Our own workers' history and farmers' history is really non-existing.
Yes, that's partly true.
And in the young people, I have a little library in the basement of my daughter's house where I've kept pamphlets and things that, you know, that you can't get anywhere. And there's somebody down there all the time looking, and, you know, and I always believed in the personal thing, you know, the emotional thing, diaries and
yes,
and things of that kind. But there isn't material. They have a hard time finding their own history. Very much like the blacks or the Indians or the, you know, where is their history? They've done a really good job at, now the women are having the same thing. I mean, there's no women history. You have to rewrite all the male books mm-hmm. about women because they're really so male and so, you know, really bad. So it's a problem for the young people to even find out what happened.
Yes, and it's extremely important to find out what happened.
You can't make a future unless you have a past.
Partly, people have to understand both what we did and where we were wrong.
Yes.
If you can't understand what we did, you don't know what the background is for what you're trying to do. And if you don't understand where we were wrong rather clearly, then you're going to make the same mistake again. You know, it's pretty clear. But I want to return to this opening thought of yours, this notion of this sort of fundamental reservoir of the democratic thought. It's there. It's a sort of a dim gleam sometimes, and one wonders if it isn't getting dangerously pushed toward extinction. Yeah. You know, the American people's mind, and that's a strange thing to talk about mind for all the people, but I really mean the climate of opinion in the United States can drift and drift and drift to a place where it would take a very, very hard thing to reawaken the original values that are ensconced in the Constitution. I'm somewhat concerned about this. I know that when we were trying to get candidates on the ballot in the Progressive Party times in very conservative places like Indianapolis, we got enough signatures solely on the basis that, don't you think we have a right to put our candidate up where he can be voted for by you or anybody else if you want to? Mm. Well, that's a pretty fundamental notion. People would sign on that basis. They wouldn't have signed. We were running a lawyer for president and a black woman for vice president. They wouldn't have signed to put a black woman up. They wouldn't have signed if they had to agree to vote for a black woman for vice president back in those days. They wouldn't have done it at all. But they were quite willing to, some of them, quite willing to put our stuff up. And the other thing I'd like to say is that, you know, I ran for office as an independent in Cleveland when I was there right after 48. And I got a large number of votes. I don't know, it was 57, 58,000 votes. I had a person could win with 105,000. So I thought of 50% or so. And the thing that's important about this is that the Korean War was on, and it was hot, and only the communists were supposed to be opposing it. And I ran squarely for the legislature on the basis of bringing that rotten war to an end. And I got signatures to get on the ballot. I had to get 10,000 or 14,000 signatures to get on the ballot, and we went right out and said, listen, the only reason I'm running, or he's running, and the only reason we're running at all is to get this issue before the people. And it's absolutely astonishing that not one of our circulators was hanged. I mean, this was a rough time, I want to tell you.
Yeah.
The curious thing is, why weren't the communists all hung from lampposts in those days? Mm. It's true they were run out of jobs, and it's true that many of them were beaten up in factories. It's all that true. Mm. But why wouldn't they hang us? Mm. Now, I don't know why they didn't hang us. I mean, there's something there. There's some point beyond which American people were not going to be pushed at that time. And so it is here. And later with McCarthy, he got away with murder, crucifying people and sabotaging the best processes of the government, which God knows weren't too good. And it wasn't until he finally attacked the army as being communist run that the whole thing got put on the TV. And once it was on the TV, their stomachs were turned. And he was gone. He was censored by the Senate in a very short time thereafter. And he was done. Now, this is the kind of thing that...
Nobody could have said that was going to happen.
No. Now, this is the kind of thing that can happen in the United States, but I want to warn of one other thing. You see, since the time when there was a real organized left in this country, and when even the New Deal was a bit left, etc., on some points, a powerful effort has been made to force every candidate who has any expectation of winning toward the center. He cannot be an extreme candidate. Now, look at what's happening to McGovern. I can't tell you what's happening, but you see the pressures. Anybody can see the pressures. Mm-hmm. And many people are saying he's been being forced to the center. But the center of what? Where is the left? There aren't any communists around that anybody knows about. Oh, well, there's communist candidates running at this time, but, you know, it's an inconsiderable number at this moment. And there isn't any organized left of the old-fashioned variety anyplace. So what is the left that he's supposed to represent? Mm. Well, it's already a center compared to past times. Uh-huh. I'm not saying anything against him at all. But he's standing in what we would have called a central position 40 years ago. Mm. But now he's sort of leftist. He's considered sort of leftist, so that the president of the Federation of Labor won't support him. He's too left for that. But here he stands in what's this not a left position, according to older thought, and he's being driven toward the center. And now the picture I'm trying to create is the climate opinion can be shaped in such a way by the liberals too. They'll help. It's not just the reactionaries. The liberals will say, well, we don't want either extreme. We don't want the fascists over here. We don't want the communists over here. We don't want either extreme. We want the mainstream, right? And then they don't never add right down the center of the road, but that's what they mean, the mainstream, right down the center of the road. Well, this fighting extremists without trying to identify what their views are. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't belong to a class called extremists. They are extremists because they're of the right, or extremists because they're of the left. And these each has principal positions. And so you start working this long enough and you weed the leftists out. So what's the next extreme? The extreme is the liberal, the guy who was in the center before. He's the next extreme. And this is the way it runs. And this is the way the Birch Society has tried to control the school boards throughout the local elections throughout the country. The same thing. And now they're working the tactic on McGovern. And frankly, I don't expect him to sell out his principles because I think his principles are embodied by the people who are supporting him. And I hope that man is wise enough to listen to the people who are supporting him. I believe he is. If he isn't, then I don't think I'm much interested in him. I think if you'll listen to the people who support him to it, they'll hold on to principles, and maybe he'll make a few things that he has to do. But as long as they hold on to the principles and they fight for him on the basis of those principles, in plain English terms, he can be whipped back into shape by the people behind him. And that's what I'm talking about, the power to create a candidate and the power to whip him back into shape. And this resides with the people. This is what the sovereignty of the people ought to be called.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that's it. But to continue this one thought lastly, the American opinion may be so manipulated so that the center, namely achieving to those principles which are of value to us in the United States Constitution, may become the left. And when it becomes the left and the extreme position, then it will be changed. And what we have to do is to fight to see that this, not only maintain this center, which is the establishment of those principles of free speech and assemblage and right to press and the rest of it, and organization. We not only have to maintain that, but we have to use those means in a radical sort of way for the purpose of changing society. We have to create a left which will make the... We have to reshift the spectrum so that the right is isolated and the center and the left are moving together. Now that's what we have to create. We have to reverse the present scheme. And unless we reverse it, this democratic adherence that lies in us will become ineffectual. It has to be related to a condition, and the condition is the existence of a powerful left whose voice is heard and whose principles are understood even if they're not accepted.
That's wonderful.
And that's where a third party comes in, period.
Yeah. Don't you think that everything is happening to create the conditions for that? I mean, like the economic...
Yes.
They're such fools, they're not even keeping up their economic standards of living of the workers.
Yes, that's right.
And this huge scientific class is being thrown out of jobs. There's two men driving taxis in Santa Fe who are main technicians at Los Alamos.
And
are they getting militant at all in the West? There's a lot of them been thrown out of the scientific world. What are they doing to fight back? You know any of them?
Well, in California, there's a state organization of these professionals, and. Again, this is a very difficult thing. Of course they should organize and they should fight for their welfare. The real problem is, what is their welfare? Should we support that association if that association pleads with the government, fights from the government for the creation of more war contracts? Well, no, we can't. But can we therefore condemn them if they do? That's the way they've been trained. We mustn't. Because if we condemn them for fighting for jobs, we have to show them how there will be, where there will be a position in a peacetime America where their talents can be used. We have to approach them with common sense, or we'll drive them into a kind of fascist alignment. You know, Germany came out of a horrible inflationary unemployment period, and it just doesn't follow, as some people seem to think it does, that all we have to have is a great big depression in this country and then the people will turn left. Yeah, they can turn fascist too.
Yeah.
You know, it's the direction of their turn that must be determined, and so do these people. It's the direction of the turn of these associations. And that's where the young people can be, I think, very important. There are two classes of people that are very important politically, if you really want to know who your political actives are. The young people, because they've got unliving energy, and they've got the capacity to work, and they want to change things. And the old people who have nothing to do but talk, like me. You know how I talk? All you have to do, all the young people have to do, is to turn a lot of us old people on who like to talk, and give us a chance to, we don't have to be given anything. If we're part of some sort of movement, where we generally approve of the principles, and we can't do the work. There's no use of our trying to push the young people out. We couldn't do the work if it was given to us. You know what your life and life, my life were like? There were times when I was up days and nights. There'd be three or four whole days where I never went to bed. Went around the state on buses, and I slept in bus stations and while I was riding the bus, and just going like this all the time. I couldn't do that, but young people can still do it if they want to. In fact, I guess they do it all the time anyway, if they need to, or anything. That's the driving energy. The young person is the driving energy of this thing, and the older person who doesn't have to work anymore, who's on a pension or something, he is one wonderful guy in the park to talk to other people. He's a wonderful guy for that purpose.